Good evening. Welcome to Holden Village. This evening in the fireside room is Bill Hutchison. Today's session number is HUB 2001-05, and it's titled, How Do We Know When the Job is Finished? Let's listen in to Bill's class.
I'm Bill Hutchison. Welcome to this. Those of you who are just coming into the village today are kind of coming in at the fifth installment of a five-part series, but each part stands alone. So today, the title is, in the whole series, Woodworking and Ministry, Tools and Techniques for Building God's Kingdom. And today, the question that is being raised is, how do we know when the job is finished? And I should give a caveat. Please take a Bible. Welcome. I should give you a caveat. When I talk about woodworking and when I talk about ministry, I'm not talking about woodworking as in this is something that I think everybody else needs to do. It's something that I do as an avocation. My first work, my vocation, is as a pastor in the north side of Chicago in a very interesting ministry where two churches both closed, sold their buildings, and consolidated and bought a office building that's about 40 years old on a main thoroughfare with off-street parking and trying to make a church that is, if you will, 21st century church, being relevant and celebrating diversity. The neighborhood that I'm in has tremendous diversity, and rather than saying the diversity is out there and the church is here, we're trying to say that the church and diversity can work together and grow accordingly in our appreciation and understanding of one another, as well as in growing into God's kingdom. My avocation of woodworking is my tangible thing that I do. Those of you who are in jobs that have a lot of input and you don't necessarily see the fruits of your labors can appreciate what some people like pastors, teachers, writers, and others who might have a lot of input and they don't necessarily get to appreciate the fruits of their labors. I'm enough of a results person that I need to see some results for my efforts, and so woodworking is something that gives me that side of my needs fulfilled. It also just gives me a chance to work with my hands. So when I talk about woodworking, I'm talking about woodworking as one example of an avocation, or one example of something that we do that is exercising other parts of our skills and our interests and our gifts. And when I talk about ministry, I'm talking about it in the broadest context possible. Luther himself talks about priesthood of all believers, and that through our baptism, we step into, we are called into, we become part of that ministry of the whole church. And it's not just ministry of church work, whether that's as a lay professional, as an ordained person. It's ministry as one of the baptized believers who is out there witnessing to God's love made real in Jesus Christ. And that can happen in your workplace, it can happen in the home, it can happen in your neighborhood, it can happen in your relationships with friends and even acquaintances and folks that we just associate with. So, having said all that, when we talk about woodworking, there's a project aspect to it. There's a start and there's a finish. And when we talk about various settings of ministry, there's typically some kind of a start and there's typically some kind of a finish. And the start might be simply when we start a new job. It might be when we move into a new neighborhood. It might be when we start a new degree program and we are associated with different folks. It might be when we join some new group, whether it's a retired persons group, whether it's a program oriented for certain kinds of folks, maybe as a continuing education program of some sort. And typically there's an end where we are no longer a part of that particular phase of our life or that project or that part of ministry or that task. And the question that I'm raising is, how do we know when the job is finished? Especially with open-ended kinds of work, it can feel like there is no end in sight. And yet, we are people who live in chronos time, according to the ticking of the clock, chronology, beginning and end. And we know our own lives have beginnings and ends. And so we are conditioned, if you will, to think in terms of beginnings and endings. And so when we have work that seems not to have an ending, how do we know when we can shift gears, or when it's time to move on, or when we need to begin another phase and bring a close to the phase that we've been in? And it's really a question that asks about discernment in our ministries and in the work that we do. Woodworking, or whatever other avocation or hobby or tangible thing that you do, we can use that as an analogy or a metaphor to kind of map over to something that's less tangible. Sometimes it's easier to think in terms of concrete things, and then we can map that over to things that are not as clear-cut, that are a little bit more ambiguous. And obviously, analogies always break down at some point. So I'm not trying to suggest here that this is the final analogy for ministry. It's just simply one that I've been exploring, and I think perhaps others of you might be exploring how you put various parts of your lives together, the things that you see as your first calling and the things that you might see as dabbling along in side interests, and maybe they even have a permanence about them. Maybe it's sewing that you've done, maybe it's clowning, maybe it's doing face makeup at festivals and fairs, maybe it's music and choir participation or performance of some sort or accompaniment. There's just a whole host of things that we might have as a side interest that continues to kind of bubble along throughout our lives. Just thinking about woodworking for a moment, and I invite you to sort of get into that space. How many of you have ever had woodworking experience directly? Okay. And how many of you have ever wished to have woodworking experience but haven't gotten there yet? Okay. And those of you who haven't had an interest or experience, just sort of get yourselves into the mindset of you're in a workshop and you've had a design, and you've got whatever tools you can imagine that you might need. If you're spinning something on a lathe, you can imagine having a lathe and various gouges that you would use, and cut off tools and parting tools and so forth. Or if you're doing something that's like a plaque and you have routing that you're doing, just kind of imagine yourself in the midst of sawdust and wonderful smelling woods and various kinds of tools. And now I ask you the question, how do you know when you're finished? How do you know when you don't have to go any farther? And one answer for me is, often I have deadlines, because I'm not doing the woodworking just for myself. I'm typically doing it as a commissioned artist or craftsperson for somebody else. And that's kind of an interesting privilege. I mean, that's not something that you just say, hey, where do I sign up to be a commissioned woodworker? It just kind of evolved that way. And one of the ways that happens is that people learn that they can rely on you meeting a deadline in some fashion or other. Otherwise, they'll move on to the next person because they need things by a certain time. And so that's one answer for me, is I have a deadline. And sometimes that correlates into our ministry settings as well. That's interesting. There's a deadline. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that the work really got finished as thoroughly as we would have liked it to, but for all practical purposes, the job is finished. The piece has to be delivered, and your interaction and your ongoing massaging or working of that piece is over. We have deadlines in our various ministry settings. Sometimes it's a group project that we're involved in. Sometimes it's a writing project. Sometimes it's a decision that needs to be made. And it may be a decision that can't be deferred again or stretched out one more time. What are some other things that clue us that the job is finished? Think about your tools and your project, and what else is going to signal that we're done with a job? Anybody?
Satisfied with the end result.
Satisfied with the end result. Say more about that. How do you know when you're satisfied? How do you know when you're satisfied?
Me, it's when I've done it, it's as good as I can get. If I go any further work anymore with it, it's going to degrade the project.
Okay. There's this, I don't know if you ever listened to National Public Radio, and they have this series called Selected Shorts that get read aloud. And some years ago, I was working in the workshop, and this one story was about this Uncle Jake who would come, and he was as thin as a rail, six foot seven, and he would eat and eat and eat like there was no tomorrow. And then all of a sudden, he would just abruptly stop. And the family would say, "Wouldn't you like anything further, Uncle Jake?" And he'd say, "No, thank you. Anything further would be a superfluity. Anything further would just be that one more notch over the top that just makes the whole thing that much less worth any effort, that much less worthwhile." And so that's what you're saying. It's satisfied with the end result, and you know that to go any further starts to degrade the whole endeavor. So it's kind of like you come up to the top, and there isn't any more up. It's either flat out or downhill from there. Other ideas, other thoughts?
Yes. Yeah, almost the opposite of that. You're sick of it. You're burned out. You hit the top, and you're on the downhill.
Tired of this. Yes, this is not. I'm tired of this marker, too.
Yeah.
Tired of this. And that certainly can be true here, too. Satisfied or tired with this. Other clues? Yes.
Well, sometimes you've met specifications. I mean, you don't necessarily, maybe you don't love it, but you've got to the point where it's reached some threshold that's either externally set or maybe you're doing 50 of the same piece and you're not going to make them all perfect, but you make them all as much the same as you can.
And I think you said minimal, right?
Yeah.
And you actually used
I was trying to be a little nicer about that. I worked for the government.
And you said specification, which gives you away as a government worker, by the way. Who else talks in industry, I guess, but yeah. Government's always talking about this, that, and the other, and specifications. Anyway, met expectations or specifications, and I put in parentheses minimal, because hopefully we've at least gotten to the minimal before we've dropped the project. And some of that, I think, can be said of our ministry. We've met expectations. We'll come back to that in a little bit. Other thoughts?
Finished goals?
Finished goals. That certainly fits with this met expectations. It's not the exact same thing, but it ties in with it.
Well, on woodworking, you put on the final coat.
Yep. And that final coat can be dependent on the kind of finish you're using, the kind of wood that you're working with, how much penetrates and soaks in, or what kind of a sheen or protection that you're, the level of protection you're trying to develop. It can also be how much time do you have for drying. I've gotten myself bollocked up into situations where, doggone it, the humidity level and the drying time that I had remaining before deadline were incompatible with one another. In other words, I felt like I was practically, you know, hand fanning the volatile fumes so that this thing would dry in time. And with humidity, as you know, it makes it much more difficult to get a good drying time. I saw a hand over here.
Well, I was just reflecting that I saw that most of those on the woodwork patch on both sides are except for the last one, I was going to use the final code appeal too.
Uh-huh.
They're sort of from within the evaluation of the worker. They don't
yes.
have very much to do
yes.
with the work itself, except for the final code.
So are you going to move us into looking at this from a more group or?
Well, I guess I applying that, I guess it was when the project is moving along smoothly enough to feel confident about handing it to someone.
Okay.
I guess,
I'm going to call that the handoff, or one might say delegation, because it might not be a complete handoff, but there might be parts that get passed along or shared. Yes.
What about when you're woodworking and the wood splits, there's a knot in the wrong place, something's gone wrong, and you gotta scrap it.
A problem develops. And just when you were thinking that you were down to the wire and things were looking great, oops, something comes along to surprise you. And we certainly have surprises in this kind of work. This consolidation of these two churches, by the way, if I talk about it as my work in this, don't understand me as saying I did it all. Alongside of me would be at least a dozen laypersons and another pastor from the other church. And it was a total of 4.5 to 5 years of discernment and whittling down from 10 churches to 8, down to 5, 2 churches closed, down to 2 churches finally, and putting it all together. There was a surprise at about year 4. And all of us were wondering, when were we going to know that it was time to be really intentional and serious about this? January 17th of 1999, I got a phone call from both the alderman, the councilman from the city of Chicago. They have, what this city council has, 50 wards, 50 different aldermen. And the ward that we were in was the 49th ward. And the 49th ward alderman called me on a Sunday afternoon, January 17th of 1999. He was in his office and he expected me to call him back on a Sunday afternoon. I also got a phone call from a lawyer representing the Chicago Public Schools and the city school board that same afternoon, also in her office, also expecting me to call her back that same afternoon. And I don't know about you, but Sunday afternoons, after being, you know, fully involved in Sunday morning activities, Sunday morning afternoons, I'm ready to just sort of coast and chill and not necessarily do messages and correspondence and so forth. So to have two urgent messages on the same Sunday afternoon really got my attention. The one ended up not being in her office when I tried to return call, but the alderman was. And he explained that he had heard we were in the process of this discussion about consolidating, wondering if we would be selling the church on Morse Avenue, and in the process, and looking for another location. And I said, yes, we were thinking about that, but that we were looking, you know, another year or two out. And he said, well, the school board would like to make you an offer and talk about doing that within the next 6 months. And I kind of had this sudden sort of sense of urgency. And then he went on to say, and the lawyer, who's also trying to reach you, represents the school board, but she also works for the same firm that's very often involved in eminent domain proceedings by the city of Chicago. And I thought, oh, gosh, this is just what I needed to hear. But I thought about it, and I said, well, maybe this is the catalyst. Maybe this is the moment where we are supposed to be getting serious about this. So rather than panicking, I kind of played a little bit of the devil's advocate and said, we need to get a lawyer because we cannot go into negotiations with the school board and all of their, you know, I'm right away thinking of a bevy of 50 lawyers when you've got a firm that deals with eminent domain proceedings, and we can't go in there pro bono or pro se representing ourselves. And that was the biggest decision, was to, could we find a lawyer, and could we afford that lawyer? Both churches were struggling. Neither had huge memberships. The whole question of viability was very much looming in our screens. And we talked about it, and we decided by the end of that month, so this is 2 weeks later, that we needed to go forward with the lawyer. And so within, I think it was within a week to 10 days, we got the lawyer, and on 2 weeks later, on the 31st of January, we were sitting down and talking with that lawyer about how to proceed. And just the retainer fee alone was enough to get us very serious about this. In fact, we couldn't afford the retainer fee by Rogers Park Lutheran Church, the church that I was with. And so this was a moment where it was clear we had a surprise, we had a problem that developed, but we also had our first opportunity to really be intentional about moving forward together on this. The other church offered to pay half of the retainer fee. And this was before we had any formal agreements as to proceeding together. This was just a goodwill gesture on their part. And if it blew up, they were out that money because they knew that we had no way of gifting back that money to them. And so sometimes surprises come, and how do we respond to those? And in that case, it led into the finish of this consolidation project, which happened then by August 1st of that year. So not even 7 full months, or not even 8 full months later, we were together legally. The two churches' names were disappeared. We had closed those two congregations, and we were a new church with a new name, Light of Christ. So surprises do come, and how do we deal with them? Sometimes it feels like you're just about to finish, and nope, we're going to launch into a whole new trajectory on this project. Yes?
The surprise is that you worked on Super Bowl Sunday.
Yes. And that the alderman and the lawyer were also working on Super Bowl Sunday. Exactly. Other thoughts about clues that we have when we know the job is finished that come to mind? Some thoughts that I had, some of which you've already said, in woodworking thoughts or terms, all the joints are tight, and I have tight in quote marks. That's a relative term. You know, there's no perfect joint, but is it good enough, and it looks good enough, and it's tight enough with the glue that it's going to hold up for the job that it needs to do. And all the blemishes are fixed. You know, the little dings that you got along the way, or the wood had a little hole that you didn't notice. And by golly, it just happens to be on the front of the piece. And so you've got to somehow address that, unless it's meant to be a part of the overall aesthetics of the piece. And if you've got several of those little holes, then it kind of looks like it's intentional. But if you've just got one, and it's big enough to be visible from 10 or 12 feet away, you got to deal with it. It's all dry. I've delivered pieces that were not quite all dry before, and they have to be handled with considerable care so that you don't end up leaving your fingerprints in the finish. And back to what you had said, satisfied with the end results. It's good looking. It has a sense of rightness about it. Nothing else needs to be added, and it looks right. With the ministry, some ideas that I came up with, some of them you've already mentioned, there's no longer a sense of fit between what we bring to the job and what the job or ministry task requires of us. And maybe that's a way in which we no longer feel called to that particular work. Or no longer a sense of urgency. How many of us can relate to seeing associates or fellow employees who just, they no longer have a sense of urgency about their work? And it's not that we need to have all of us being anxious and fretful about what we're doing, but I'm talking about the other end of the spectrum where there's just this real blasé blue kind of attitude. And it's sometimes it leads into a kind of a really negative, whining, complaining kind of posture. But sometimes it's just a, we can all relate to the, and I hate to pick on the government again, Bruce, but we can all relate to walking up to a desk of a bureaucracy somewhere, and there's this kind of next attitude. And, you know, you just sense a real heaviness about that person, the burden that doesn't allow them to be present in their work in a way that hopefully most of us would feel more positive about. No longer a sense of focus. You know, maybe we're finding ourselves very distracted in our work. And that can be a clue that something's not at something's at odds, something's not fitting well with our work and with our skills and our interests. Or maybe there's no longer a sense of content, as that is to say that we are malcontent or discontent, that we just don't feel like our work is meaningful or is fruitful or is hope-filled or is doing anything significant. We just don't have a sense of content. And I want to go back to where we were starting to talk about these two, met expectations and finished goals. My experience has been, both in woodworking and in ministry, that sometimes I'm not as clear on my goals or expectations as I thought I was. And so what ends up happening is, inadvertently, my expectations drift or they get ratcheted up. Typically, they get ratcheted up. Once in a while, they get ratcheted down. And so then my sense of trying to finish the job on time, if it's a woodworking deadline, or to finish it in an extra level of expertise, that maybe I'm really not yet there in my experience. And so I'm trying to do too much, and my expectation is starting to be unrealistic given the time frame, given my skill level, and given the wood and the type of project that I'm working with. And in the same way, I think it's possible for us to find ourselves in tight corners with ministry that we're doing, where suddenly we see ourselves as somehow more responsible for what needs to be done than maybe is really realistic. And so we might take on too much responsibility. And I think people who are somehow involved in leadership roles somehow find it easy at times to step past a bounded kind of leadership style to where it becomes almost all-encompassing. And I would hazard a guess to say that pastors have a big struggle with this. Maybe not more than any others, but at least as much as others, where suddenly, you know, it's not just the ministry of word and sacrament, but now it's the ministry of property and finances, or the ministry of committees and council, or so forth and so on. And clearly a pastor has to be involved in various aspects of the overall picture, but sometimes I think pastors get to a point where they, and I've struggled with this in the midst of all the changes that we've had to go through, of getting into the micromanaging of details and not leaving enough for others to do and not handing off and delegating. And sometimes it's difficult for us to remember, you know, catch me a fish and I eat for a day, teach me to fish and I eat for a lifetime. It's more difficult to teach somebody to fish. It's more time consuming. It's just easier sometimes to go and do it yourself. And it's very expedient. But in the long run, it's maybe not necessarily the most faithful way to go about doing things. And so, even though the job is done, maybe the real job is left undone, which is to help others know their gifts and discern where they fit in and be welcomed into community to offer what they have. Sounds like we have a little competition out here. Meeting goals, finishing our goals. Sometimes the goals that we have in mind in our ministry projects are less clear than they seemed at first. With this consolidation process, we went into it with the goal of discerning how we as sister congregations could be more faithful in our witness on the north side. That was our goal. The goal wasn't to consolidate, and the goal wasn't to create some superstructure involving 10 or 5 or 2 or however many congregations. It was, how can we discern a more faithful witness as however many of us finally did something together? And it was because of that fairly broad goal, but also fairly specific goal, that we could then say, ah, it seems that consolidation of our two congregations is the way that we can, at this time, have the most faithful witness on the north side. In another time, maybe 30 years ago, we might have come up with a different answer. We might have said, let's do shared confirmation ministry, or let's do a shared pastorate where you have two pastors but that they work together, or let's have a shared Christian education director, or whatever. We might have come up with some other configuration. Sometimes we don't spell out the goals clearly enough. And sometimes it might be even, say, let's talk about a council meeting. What is our goal for a council meeting? We had to reshape how we did council meetings. Rather than just going through all the reports and just looking at any financial decisions that were looming in front of us, we also decided to have the first 45 minutes devoted to what we called strategic planning. Because we noticed that we were always doing the strategic planning in whatever leftover time there was at the end of the meeting, and doing the sort of perfunctory things, the administrivia, at the front end of the meeting, which inevitably took up the bulk of our meeting time. And then when our energy was the lowest and the people were looking at the watches the most, we were trying to do our strategizing, which is that longer range, looking out at our goals and how is our goal for this serving our mission, and how are we being faithful to that. And so we decided to turn it around and to have the front end of the meeting for 45 minutes, and we knew we had to set a time limit so that it wouldn't just keep going on into the rest of the meeting as the front-loaded energy up kind of time of the meeting. And it's amazing how that simple flip-flopping of time was really a flip-flopping of priorities, and was saying that we see strategizing and looking ahead as at least important enough, or even perhaps more important, than some of the regular reports and business decisions. And it's also interesting because once we had done brainstorming at the front end and talked about long-term goals and mission, many of the so-called perfunctory decisions were that much quicker to be made because we had already talked through some of the rationale and the faith questions and didn't have to rehash those, and we could just move right into the decision in a fairly informed way. I wanted to look at some scriptures as a way of another set of clues about how we know when the job is finished. And the first one is the one for the theme for this summer, Called by Name. And that's in Isaiah 43, verses 1 through 3. And may I have a volunteer to read that for us out loud?
But now thus says the Lord, He who created you, O Jacob, He who formed you, O Israel, do not fear, for I have redeemed you. I have called you by name. You are mine. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you, and through the rivers, they shall not overwhelm you. When you walk through the fire, you shall not be burned, and the flame shall not consume you. For I am the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel, your Savior.
Thank you. That's right where we need to stop. I'm suggesting, and maybe we haven't thought about this particular passage before in terms of being finished, but I'm suggesting that we can see a sense of completion in here. First of all, it's the past tense, formed and created and called. And then there's a sense of future anticipation when you pass through, and I will be with you, and they shall not, the rivers shall not overwhelm you. One of the ways that we know something is finished is that there's a readiness for come what may after the end point of the stage of before. And so here is this prophecy of the formation, the creation and the formation and the redemption are completed. And there's a readiness now for whatever lies ahead. And before this, there wasn't that sense of readiness or that certainty of readiness, but now there is that readiness.
Hello.
And why? Because I am the Lord your God. There's that sense of ongoing connection, ongoing relationship. Let's take a look at any other thoughts about that passage that come to mind, thinking of this theme verse. Let's take a look at Ecclesiastes 3, 1 through 8. Some of you will recognize this right away. Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verses 1 through 8.
Where's it? Okay. Page number?
I thought I had all mine marked in here.
6:30.
After Solomon's before Isaiah.
3, 1 through 8?
Yes, chapter 3, 1 through 8.
Okay. This is right here at the top. Solomon's Tower of Ecclesiastes. For everything there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven. A time to be born, a time to die. A time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to break down, a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to throw away stones and a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to seek and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to throw away, a time to tear and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace.
Thank you. Well, this is one of those time-worn passages where it clearly marks out that there are various seasons and stages of our life. And there's also, I think, a reassurance here that while we are in the midst of conflict, that there will be a time when the conflict ceases and there's peace and tranquility. Or conversely, we can say that if things seem awfully even-keeled, we shouldn't be too comforted, because surely there will be a surprise or a wrinkle or an issue that comes up that we need to deal with. So we kind of live in this staged, seasoned life that's peppered with interruptions, and ministry is that way. I don't think I can come up with too many jobs with exceptions of perhaps assembly line type work, but even there I think there are enough surprises from week to week, if not from day to day or hour to hour. As monotonous and as routine as things might seem, there's something that develops, a glitch, a surprise, a wrinkle. And that's partly just the nature of things, but it's also something that we can embrace as challenging us to use those reserves, those other skills that we might not feel like we normally have to use on the job, or it gives us opportunities to be creative. Certainly that's true in woodworking. You have that split in the wood. Now what do I do? Do I start all over? Can I somehow wedge these glued joints apart without destroying all of the pieces surrounding the one that I need to replace? Do I do a whole other repeat using wood that's superior to the wood that I used the first time around? And in the same way, we have situations in our work where we have to say, you know, maybe there was a better way to do this than I did the first time around. We can learn from our mistakes. Sometimes we can find old patterns working well for us again with maybe a slight adjustment, but sometimes we really need to just re-cue, even do a paradigm shift. And that's one of the things that we were very concerned about with this discernment process as congregations on the north side of Chicago. We kept saying to ourselves, it's not enough just to do the same thing that maybe was done 20 or 25 or 30 years ago. We have to do things in a way that meets where people are today. And part of that was recognizing that the neighborhood had changed significantly There were many more Hispanic persons coming into our midst, many more folks moving in and out in shorter time periods than in previous years. Maybe instead of staying 5 to 7 years in the neighborhood, they might only be there 2 to 3 years. So just that whole sense of transition and the pace of it being stepped up means that we would have to meet and connect and invite people in different ways. And instead of expecting the signs pointing people to the church to be enough to get people there, we have to be almost out in the neighborhood. We have to be posting signs in the schools, wherever they'll let us do that. We have to be talking to business, neighborhood business owners. We have to be involved in some of the local citizen groups, like the CAPS program, the what is that called? Community Alternative Policing Strategy is what the CAPS program stands for. And while that sounds like an odd thing for a church to be involved in, it's a great way to get a cross-section of the community involved in some of the current hot issues of the neighborhood and to be seen as being responsible and concerned about the safety and well-being of the neighborhood. So it's a natural place to connect with people and so forth and so on. There are those kinds of opportunities. And rather than just waiting for requests for people to come into the church for use of space, we need to be about the business of engaging with people and the concerns of the neighborhood, and not just quote unquote on a religious train of thought, but in a broader scope than that. Other thoughts about this passage before we move on to the next? Yes?
The one thing I liked about it, which I had thought about before, is, you know, my kind of work, and I'm sure a lot of people in the room, the same thing. You get going on a project that is interesting to you, and then it always gets trumped by, you know, something that comes urgent, that it's the end of the month, you got to pay the bills, or you got to do something else. And the projects tend to lie fallow, and then you have a corner of the basement where there's three or four things that, you know, if you just had a half a day, you could finish something and finally get them done. And but this, for the first time reading this thing out loud, what it really does is it says that, you know, this is ordained. I mean, this would, the model here is, you know, there's a time to get this done. There's a time to finish something. And there's another time where it's, you know, it pretty much breaks things into you're doing this or you're not doing it, as compared to most of my life, which is, I'm going to get to it. Is, you know, it's a painful thing where, you know, eventually you figure, you know, they're going to run you through a funeral service and then your projects are done. But, in the, you know, so this makes me want to go back and look at some of those things that are kind of sitting there waiting to be completed, because getting something done, like you're saying with your projects here, is what you really need to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is God telling you, maybe in some way, and get it finished.
And I know, for me anyway, I get fueled for the next thing by finishing something. Because mm-hmm. it's no longer this sense of accountability to yet another demand. It's just this thing that I can let go of, or in a sense that lets go of me. It's no longer pulling on my attention and my time, and I can move on and be freed from that burden. And I don't mean it as a burden, like something that was shoved my way, because many times we choose these things that come our way, or we choose to accept them or not if they come our way, to the extent that we have that kind of control. But after a while, if we haven't felt like we've progressed as much as we'd like to, they start to feel burdensome. And like you say, if they pile up and accumulate.
Well, and that brings something else to mind as a layperson, that been in a couple of congregations where you do a big thing, a building project, or we haven't been involved in mergers, but you do something like that, and as soon as something is done, the congregation sits around going, you know, the pastor's going to split. I mean, this is, you know, and that's what I'm, one of the things, you get a big project and the pastor is fully involved in getting something done and writing the goals and, you know, beating the drum and dragging the laity into leadership positions and fundraising and all that stuff, and you're finally done, and it's like, oh, you know, gotta get out of here. And I don't know how many people have had that kind of experience, but I guess what in this context with woodworking, how do congregations, how would your laity keep you interested in pushing beyond something like this? Because that's, I think when something is finished, sometimes, you know, a lot of things finish, and maybe some of them aren't always the best for the congregation?
It's an interesting question you raise, because we had two pastors and two churches, and both pastors were invited to stay on beyond the closing of two congregations and the consolidation and creation of the new. And the one chose not to. She had been there 10 years. She had had a particularly rough start, being a woman with a largely male council when she first started. She was fresh out of seminary. And I mean, this is not an unusual story by any means. This happens a lot, where a woman pastor has a harder time establishing credibility with that kind of posture on the part of a council. And she said after 10 years, she wasn't feeling called to staying on. And she was also of an age, about 10 years older than I am, where she said, you know, I really want to go into more spiritual direction kinds of work. And if I'm going to get the training, I need to do that now, so that I have enough time to really engage in that. Myself, I had only been at the other congregation half the time that she had been at the church she was at, and I was feeling still energized by the process and ready to go. And it's interesting, because the congregation has been very grateful for my staying on. They've had a sense of continuity and moving across that bridge of change, if you will. And I had no way of knowing ahead of time, you know, whether that was going to work for me personally or for the congregation, or whether I would end up, you know, somehow being in the way of really shifting gears and moving into this new mode. But it's worked out pretty well. And I keep that question in my mind, you know, am I still fresh and energized enough to keep moving us forward, or am I becoming tired and less focused on keeping that vision in front of us? And at that point, then I would have to say, maybe it's time for me to move on. We also called a second pastor, and by having that first pastor leave, who was a Northern European woman, Northern European American woman, then we were able to call African American woman. We were specifically wanting to keep the genders mixed, but we also wanted to keep the ethnic backgrounds mixed, because that's part of our intentionally modeling diversity that we're trying to welcome and invite. And all because we see that as part of God's kingdom is really one of tremendous diversity. And in a neighborhood like Rogers Park, which is at the north end of Chicago, right by the lake, you have a neighborhood teeming with diversity, and to have less than that sense of calling for a congregation's mission just doesn't seem faithful. It seems like it's becoming an exclusive rather than an inclusive kind of mission goal. I saw another hand back there.
Yeah, a couple of things. One is, I think we always, when we read Ecclesiastes, we quit too soon.
Okay.
If you turn to verse 13 says, God wants nothing better for his children than to eat, drink, and enjoy his toil.
Okay.
So that reminds me that when we're going through this, we should be enjoying life, not having to produce or being so pressured that we don't enjoy the journey.
So that not just the end result is important, but the actual means or route that we take in getting there.
And the other thing is in verse 11, I think, it always strikes me that God has put eternity into man's mind to know that there is something further and something more and something out there. And I mean, that just puts me in this state a lot, thinking about that.
That brings up something that I was going to get to, and so you've just given me a good segue. We've all heard about ultimate things, ultimate decisions, ultimate goals, and so forth. And what you just talked about are, when we talk about eternity and salvation and God's kingdom, those are ultimate things. I mean, can we come up with anything that's even more ultimate than that? In our faith perspective, that's what we understand is ultimately going to happen. God's kingdom will be fully realized. But in the meantime, and this is a word that some of you may be familiar with, if not all of you, and that's penultimate things. That is to say, the things that have to do with ultimate direction, but that are realized in the meantime, and that lead up to ultimate things. And so maybe part of our faith journey is to be about penultimate goals. That is, goals that we feel nourished in, that we are called to, and not just personal goals, but I'm talking about communal goals. Because in order to be shooting for ultimate things, you don't just get there, you know, in one leap. You have to take some kind of step between where we are and where we ultimately want to end up, and those become the kind of penultimate incremental things in the meantime. One way we talked about this in our discernment process was, if nothing happened, if we didn't do anything differently than we've already been doing things as a congregation, where would we see ourselves 20 years out? And typically it was a relatively hopeless picture that was kind of like a flat line. And then the question was, well, let's think about an ideal or hoped for picture of where we would like to be in 20 years. And it was things like men, women, and children of all ages and all ethnic backgrounds and all socioeconomic levels, you know, a full worship expression and a vibrance and so forth. And so that was kind of like this goal up here somewhere. And so we had where we are, where we would be if no change, and where we would hope to be. And you can kind of see there was this angle of difference or angle of opportunity. And then, if this is our hope for picture, the idea is, what do we need in order to arrive at that? What would it take? And so that makes you work one step back. And then you take that point and you say, okay, and what do we need to get to that point? And you work one more step back. And it's kind of the way it's kind of the way that architects work, where they have a design and then they figure out what materials and laborers do they need to get to that, and what resources do you need to be able to get to those laborers and materials, and then is the customer able to provide those things that then lead to the resources that lead to the construction, that lead to the design. And so it's kind of like working backwards. And in a way, that's what we're called to do. If the ultimate goal, as people of faith, is to be about building God's kingdom, and ultimately it's God who builds the kingdom, but we participate in that project, or we don't, or at least we try not to, or maybe by lethargy, we sort of don't really help or contribute. But if that's our ultimate goal, to share in the building of God's kingdom, then what are we doing in the meantime with our everyday lives? And so, you're right. We have these larger purposes, these larger realities toward which we, as a community of disciples, are involved in moving toward. And obviously we fall short of the mark. Yesterday we talked about how do we deal with mistakes that we make, both in woodworking as well as in our ministry. And we know about sin and redemption and reconciliation. And it's because of those things, the reality of being at the same time saint and sinner, that we can press on, knowing that we never quite get it fully right, our trajectory, but that we also are never totally off the path either. Even if we are apparently catatonic in a stage in our life, maybe that's really a discernment period. And if we're discerning with these ultimate things in mind, then there's still this faith journey, even though it doesn't look like we're going anywhere. But we're still on that path because it's leading toward a particular destination, or at least it has a particular destination in mind. Any other thoughts about Ecclesiastes before we look at a few other passages? How about Acts 1, 6 through 8? And can I have another reader, please? Acts 1, verses 6 through 8.
So when they had come together, they asked him, Lord, is this the time when you will restore the kingdom to Israel? And he replied, It is not for you to know the times or periods that the Father has set by his own authority, but you will receive power when the Holy Spirit has come upon you, and you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem and all of Judea and Samaria and to the ends of the earth.
The reason I picked this passage, thank you, the reason I picked this passage is because we talked earlier about chronos, time, the concept of history, one thing after another. And there's also here a sense of what the Greek word kairos, that is to say God's time. When God acts in human history, but not according to any kind of regular routine schedule, but just in a kind of divine will sort of way, as God sees fit at particular times. And we can think of things like the Exodus experience. We can think of the Pentecost experience in Acts. And in our own lives, I think there are kairos moments. For me, a kairos moment was the time that my girlfriend Christy and I were sitting and talking, and in her Christy-like way, she went through a sort of 5-minute discursus about something, and then finally she stopped and she took a breath and she said, I guess what I'm really trying to say is I think it would be neat if we could get married. And that was it. She didn't ask me, and I never asked her. She just kind of came out with this sort of conclusive answer or suggestion. And I said, well, I've been thinking about that for a long time, and I think that's a great idea. So when do we want to do it? And that was it. It was kind of this moment of clarity, and I really feel like God was present in that moment for us to be ready to move on with such a serious commitment. And now we've just celebrated 18 years in this past June. There are other kairos moments in our lives, and this passage from Acts kind of reminds us of this kairos time, and in the meantime, we are to go out and witness to Samaria, Judea, and all the rest. Any other thoughts about this passage? I'm trying to use these as things to sort of tickle our imagination a little bit about what might feel like the humdrum routines that we're in sometimes. How about Galatians 6, 7 through 10? And can we have another reader here, please?
Do not be deceived. Verse 7.
Yes.
Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For you reap whatever you sow. If you sow to your own flesh, you will reap corruption from the flesh. But if you sow to the Spirit, you will reap eternal life from the Spirit. So let us not grow weary in doing what is right, for we will reap at harvest time if we do not give up. So then, whenever we have opportunity, let us work for the good of all, and especially for those of the family of faith.
Thank you. This passage I picked, getting back to what this gentleman over here was talking about, rather than thinking about all of these concerns and questions of when are we finished in terms of our own personal journey only, but thinking about it in a more community way and recognizing that together as a community, we are assured that there is a harvest time, that there is a difference in doing right, and that the way we get where we're trying to go makes a difference. Not just the end result, but the actual route, the means that we take. Not that we're ever going to find the perfect route, but that it's an intentionality, an accountability, and a discerning. Always asking the question, where is God leading us in this moment, in this problem, in this opportunity, in this step of the journey? And hopefully this passage can be a reassurance to us that taking that time along the way to ask that discernment question really does make a difference in the long run. Kind of getting back to that penultimate versus ultimate kinds of things. Any other thoughts about that passage?
You know, I've been thinking about this the last few minutes, about the importance of process and its separation maybe from result. Mm-hmm. And the passage just before this one, you know, was talking about God's time and so forth. And the point about it is that one point is that we don't control things. Mm-hmm. And a personal example is, I like catching fish, but it's the fishing I hate. and I realize that I don't understand the process very well. I mean, I have a cursory idea, but I don't understand the process and how to do it well. So I'm not a good fisherman.
Okay.
And there are so many things that we don't control that sometimes we need to do the best we can in our process, but we can't hold too tightly to the result. Mm-hmm. And I was curious about that. This is sort of a personal, I'm not asking you to answer this, but it seems to me that if you don't like the process of woodworking, you mentioned the fragrances of the wood, and I can sort of feel how the wood feels when I'm working with it and so forth. If you don't like that process, for one thing, you're not likely to come up with a good piece. Mm. And secondly, you might be tremendously disappointed in a piece that has a flaw or breaks or something else. Mm-hmm.
I think that's a really interesting insight. And the same could be said with if we're doing sculpture, clay, or music, where we feel like we got the piece pretty well in hand, but there was just this one section of music where for those few measures it just seems a little murkier or unresolved in some way. So there are times where I feel guilty cutting with power tools in these trees that have grown for 30, 40, 50, 70 years, and I think to myself, who am I to be spending 30, 40, 50 hours on a project and pretending to make something more beautiful than the wood created in the first place by growing in its way of growing. And then I think to myself, well, okay, maybe I'm trying to just bring out the beauty that's in the wood in the first place. And so that's kind of where I go with all of that. And I was especially feeling that way when I was cutting ebony. Ebony is extremely expensive. It's probably 10 to 12 times the cost of walnut, and walnut's probably about twice the cost of maple or oak. And so when you're starting to cut on ebony, you think to yourself, I better be really sure that this is exactly where I want to cut, because it's going to be a costly error if I deviate from where I want to cut. So, yeah, that sense of...
But then sometimes, if you are expecting perfection, mm-hmm. and you make a mistake, but sometimes that choice to alter that comes out better than you had anticipated in the first place.
That's right. And if I could go back to that consolidation example, I would not have chosen to have an alderman and a lawyer be the catalyst for this process. Really urgently on track. But it turns out that was terrific, because what ended up happening was the building ultimately got torn down after we sold it. And if you don't think it's hard enough to give up a space, a sacred space, then to know that it's going to be torn down, that's almost like insult to injury after taking such a leap of faith. But the one thing that made it work for those who had the most difficulty was that it was going to be for a school, to help relieve the overcrowding for the children, so that there was, in a sense, a larger purpose rather than just a commercial developer coming in and building something for profit, that there was a sense of a legacy of helping further the next generation or two of kids having more classroom space. This one school that was two blocks away from the church had 1,500 students and was designed for 800 students, and they had gotten into the mobile trailer classrooms, and they were actually, this is the strangest thing, there was a church across the street, St. Jerome's Catholic Church, and they were actually renting space from their school, which had been closed as a parochial school, and so there were public school students for 10 or 12 years in the parochial school plant. And that's just a strange state of affairs when that happens. That looks like our time.
Thank you.
I hope this has been helpful in terms of thinking about the ministry that we do and maybe some avocation hobbies that we do and where our faith journey walks through all that. Thank you very much.
Thank you.